The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 06. That order is publicly available on the governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Today's meeting, as we've just stated, is also being recorded, so should you be a speaking participant today and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now or at any time. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will be facilitating today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91-A, there are a few logistics that we need to establish. Each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us during roll calls, and it will be done like this. With this roll call, I am Jerry Little, Director of the Gopher Office in the Gopher Office at One Eagle Square on Main Street in Concord, New Hampshire. With me in the room today are Rhonda Hensley, Lisa English, and Wendy Gilman. Senate President Donna Soucy, are you with us?
Yes. Good afternoon, Commissioner Little. This is Donna Soucy. I am at my home in Manchester, and I'm alone.
Thank you. House Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Yes, Jerry, I'm here, and I'm at my cabin in Bethlehem, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thanks, GOP Leader Senator Chuck Morse.
Yes, Jerry, I'm here, and I'm in my office in Atkinson, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
GOP Leader from the House, Dick Hinch.
Dick Hinch here. I'm in my office in Merrimack, and I am alone.
Chairman Senator Lou D'Alessandro.
Lou D'Alessandro, I'm in my kitchen in Manchester, and I'm by myself.
Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
Representative Mary Jane Wallner, and I'm in my house in Concord, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you. Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan, I'm in my office in Deerfield.
And Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy, I'm in my house in Littleton with my two minor children.
Thank you. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to please identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call following the process we just used. And finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to use 5-star if you would like to ask a question. That pops your name up on our screen here so we can identify you. Also, presenters are asked to hit 5-star when their turn comes up to allow us to unmute your line. Are there any questions before we begin today's scheduled presentations? I see I do have a question from Representative Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Just, Jerry, you've done a wonderful job keeping this train on schedule. But just a reminder that the governor has a very important press conference at 3 o'clock, which I'm sure all of us would like to hear. So just to keep that in mind, if you could.
That's, Mr. Speaker, that's an excellent point. Our agenda today does carry us beyond that point. Is your preference that we, or I'll ask the board, is your preference that we suspend shortly before 3 o'clock and try to reschedule people possibly for Monday?
That would be my preference, yes.
Can we hear some other thoughts and comments from others on the Legislative Advisory Board?
Yeah, I'd support that. I think that's a good idea. Lou D'Alessandro.
Senator Soucy?
Thank you. I also support the idea, but I wondered if at all possible, if we didn't have a lot of questions, if we could move through our agenda more quickly as we did the other day. So just to put people towards the end of the agenda perhaps on notice that they may be able to come up earlier. That way it would reduce some of the need to further reschedule.
Okay, well then, why don't we then just get right to it and see if we can't march through the agenda reasonably quickly. So the first item on your agenda today is a report from Lisa English, the Assistant Director for Policy and Intergovernmental Affairs here at the Gopher office. And Lisa has been asked to give you a presentation of other related federal funds outside of the CARES Act funds, the $1.25 billion that we are working to distribute. So I'm not going to spend any more time on this, Lisa. Please go right ahead.
Thank you, Director Little and members of the board. My name is Lisa English. I'm going to talk very briefly, and I will try to not get the same amount of information into a less amount of time because it will be hard to understand if I start speaking at the fastest rate possible. But our shared mission here is related to the coronavirus relief funds, and that's the $1.25 billion in what's been described as the federal flex funds. So while the scope of our, I'll call it jurisdiction, is related to those funds, it's helpful to understand what funding is available as we hear about the needs across the state. And to be clear, just because there are federal funds and they may have a tremendously large number attached to it, just because those funds are available, that does not mean that there isn't an additional need. So I just wanted to start with that. There are four pieces of legislation that collectively provide a number of these funding opportunities for the state, as well as for certain industries and providers, to help New Hampshire in navigating through the COVID-19 public health emergency. This includes supports for the healthcare system, public and social services, and small and large businesses. Those four pieces of legislation, very quickly, are the Coronavirus Preparedness and Response Supplemental Appropriations Act, and that was from early March. Mid-March was the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We're all familiar, I think, with the CARES Act from March 27th. That's otherwise known as the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. And then April 24th, the Payment Protection Program and Healthcare Enhancement Act had been signed into law. There's a handout that was sent, and I believe it's on the website, about federal funding opportunities related to COVID-19. This is an ever-expanding list, and this really is just a sampling of some of the things that are out there. And I'm going to go over a few, perhaps a few less than I had originally intended, just to help move the schedule along. Support for healthcare providers. I think everyone has heard about what started out as a $100 billion public health and social services emergency fund. It's been described in a lot of different ways. I've heard it described as the hospital fund, even though it's not just hospitals, or the Marshall Plan for hospitals. This fund is for grants for eligible healthcare providers, and that includes not just hospitals, but public entities, not-for-profit entities, and Medicare and Medicaid enrolled suppliers and institutional providers. There's been an additional $75 billion allocated to that fund. The grants can be used to cover unreimbursed COVID-19-related expenses or lost revenue, building structures, leasing property, getting equipment and supplies, including PPE, retrofitting facilities, and preparing for a surge. HHS, the federal HHS, began disbursement of its first $30 billion in grants to eligible providers. For New Hampshire, that disbursement resulted in payments to 1,445 providers for a total of $164,580,386 approximately. I believe that just over $100 million of that was received by New Hampshire hospitals. For the next round of payments, New Hampshire providers are expected to receive just under $16 million of payments, although it's a much smaller pool of providers that are expected to receive payments there. So that is one large fund that New Hampshire is seeing the benefit of. There are certainly some concerns by some providers about how the calculation is being made, and we're monitoring that and will provide further information as we have it. Another area of financing or funds is the Health Resources and Services Administration Funds for Health Centers, or HRSA. Congress allocated $100 million for health centers for COVID response, and then the CARES Act also added $1.3 billion. New Hampshire, 10 health centers received a total of just under $7.5 million through that fund. Another possible bucket is the SAMHSA grant, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. The CARES Act provided $425 million to SAMHSA for grants, and they began a grant program New Hampshire applied for and received a $2 million grant. I'm going to not go over, and it's not on the chart yet, but I will continue to update this, some of the long-term supports and services. There are emergency appropriations for the Administration for Community Living that has funding for home and community-based services, home-delivered meals, some funds for Centers for Independent Living, as well as funds for a family caregiver support program. A few of the social services and education funding that's out there. The Community Development Block Grant. The CARES Act allocated $5 billion for the CDBG. New Hampshire is to receive approximately $7.5 million, with $5.4 million to be administered through the Community Development Finance Authority, along with amounts being sent to Manchester, Nashua, Portsmouth, Dover, and Rochester. A couple examples that we've seen and we'll hear more about today, child care. The CARES Act provided an additional $3.5 billion nationally for the child care and development block, the block grant. New Hampshire has received just under $7 million to support child care. And New Hampshire is using some of those funds to continue payments and assist child care providers in the case of decreased enrollment or closures to assure providers are able to remain open to provide child care services for our essential workers, including our frontline workers. The CARES Act allocated $4 billion nationally for homeless assistance grants. New Hampshire has received a total of $3.7 million, with Manchester receiving $540,000 of those funds. DHHS is the recipient of the statewide funds and is using those funds to provide a stipend for 8 weeks to increase salaries for individuals that provide person-to-person care. DHHS is also providing direct aid to homeless shelters and will support building more affordable housing targeted for homeless populations. The education, there's funding for education, both for elementary and secondary schools, which those funds will be distributed to schools using the Title I formula, which is based on population and poverty. There's the Higher Education Emergency Relief Fund. The majority of those funds will be distributed directly to colleges and universities based on the Pell Grant recipient enrollment. Half of those funds must be used by institutions, at least half, for the emergency financial aid grants to students. We've heard a lot about the Paycheck Protection Loan Program, which had started with a $349 billion and has had an additional $310 billion allocated through the statute that was passed last week. New Hampshire, out of that first round of funding, it's estimated that 11,582 New Hampshire businesses received a total of over $2 billion into the state. There's a number of other programs, but just for purposes of time, I'm going to leave it there. We will continue to update the chart of the funding opportunities, and I know that the LBA has done a wonderful job of preparing a more robust report of New Hampshire-specific funds. Additionally, the Stakeholder Advisory Board has asked for just a one-page summary of the four different federal grants that are out there, and by that I mean the four different federal legislative actions, and we'll make sure that that's available for board members here as well, and it will be posted on our website. So that was 20 minutes done in 11. I hope I didn't speak too quickly, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Well done, Lisa. Questions for Lisa? Not seeing or hearing any. Senator D'Alessandro, we still have a question mark beside your name. Was that a previous question? Do you still have a question, sir?
Yeah, that was of the previous question, so I'm all set. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we do have a question from Representative Mary Jane Wallner.
Thank you, Mr. Little. Lisa, I was wondering, all of these funds will be, these funds that you've gone through today, some of these will not flow through this advisory committee. These funds will flow directly from the federal government to the Department of Health and Human Services or directly to the community development fund, whatever department is appropriate. Is that correct?
That's correct. The only purpose to raise them is so that we all understand what funding is out there, and that can help when we're looking at sort of a triage and what's the urgency. It doesn't tell the full story of what the unmet need is, or, for example, with some of the healthcare payments, what healthcare providers are essentially being left out because of how the formula has been developed. And it was developed in a way to try and get money out as quickly as possible. So, yes, these are not part of, I'm putting air quotes, this is not part of our jurisdiction, but it certainly helps inform us about the need as we try to make recommendations on the best and most efficient use of the funds that are available.
Great. And just one further question. As we go forward, and we've been hearing requests, Can we get more information a little bit deeper into these federal funds that are not within the $1.25 billion so that we can see how they would relate if we were giving grants to certain segments of the economy? Can we get more detail about these?
Absolutely, yes. I had this dream at some point that there would be an easy memo to finish, but because we're constantly looking to see every day what new funding mechanisms are available, what new funding mechanisms are being operationalized, it's changing every day. But our hope is to get as much of this information, not just for the advisory board, but for the public as a whole. And there are some federal sources, for example, the HRSA funds. They are posting each grantee. Now, granted, it was 10 health centers in New Hampshire, but it was pretty easy to find right down to the dollar how much each healthcare center received in the state of New Hampshire.
Great. Thank you. That's really going to be helpful. Thank you so much.
Any further questions for Lisa English? Don't see or hear any. So thank you very much, Lisa. Excellent presentation. We're going to move on now to our 1:30 presentation. It is relative to public safety, and we have on the line with us William McQuillan, President of the Professional Firefighters Association. Mr. McQuillan, you are supposed to be joined, I believe, by Scott Naismith from the New Hampshire Police Association. We do not see Mr. Naismith on the line. It's possible that he's there, but not showing up as a speaker. So if you're with us, Mr. Naismith, if you would hit 5-star, that will allow us to identify you from among the many, many people who are on the call this afternoon. Mr. McQuillan, are you ready to move forward with your presentation?
I am, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon. To the members of the Legislative Advisory Board.
If I could interrupt for a second, we see that Mr. Naismith has signed in here, so we have him identified. So sorry for the interruption. Go right ahead.
Oh, no problem. My name is William McQuillan, and I'm speaking to you today from Portsmouth at my home, where I'm alone, save for my dog seated next to me. I am the president of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire, and I wanted to thank you all for allowing me to speak on the behalf of the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire. The Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire represent about 2,000 active and retired firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, and dispatchers across the state of New Hampshire, serving roughly 65% of our nation's, our state's population. I serve as not only as president, but I am also a firefighter in the city of Portsmouth. I'm still active, where I currently serve the rank of captain on an engine, and I've been there for about 30 years. But I'm here today representing the Professional Firefighters of New Hampshire and myself. And before I begin, I just wanted to take a moment and publicly acknowledge and thank my members and the members of the fire service in this state who have never missed a call for service in this pandemic that we're encountering. That despite all the concern and the fear and the issues that are ongoing, they continue to show up and serve the public as they're supposed to. And it gives me a great amount of pride to be able to represent the men and women that I do. Additionally, I wanted to thank the federal and state leadership for their efforts. It's certainly been a team effort, making sure that our members and the folks on the front lines have the tools and resources that they need to be able to keep the public safe and to make sure that we have what we need. The Department of Safety, Commissioner Quinn and Assistant Commissioner Plummer, and the Fire Marshal Paul Parisi, and over at Homeland Security Director Jen Harper, have done a great job of making sure that folks like me are kept in the loop about decision-making, and more importantly, that they're taking our input with respect to what needs to happen for folks on the front lines and what we're seeing and hearing and what we need, more importantly. But it is certainly a partnership that's been made here that has kept the public's best interest at mind. So I just wanted to acknowledge them and thank them. And before I begin, I had asked to testify before you all before realizing that Fire Marshal Parisi was going to be testifying on Wednesday, and I did offer some input to his testimony. So my remarks are going to be very brief, especially given the idea here that we all have something that we'd like to see happen at 3 o'clock and want to make sure we see it live. So again, thank you for taking the time here to hear us out and for making sure that we have the funding on our protective equipment and the PPE that we need. We all agree that there needs to be more done to protect the public and protect the members who are serving our communities and taking more risk. More than 100 of our members have had to quarantine from coming in contact with individuals that have been infected with the COVID-19 virus, and many of them had to go to state facilities or hotels out of fear that they may infect their families. In fact, as I speak to you right now, there are 29 of my members that are away from their families and are in some sort of isolation, either waiting for a test result or waiting for the 14-day period for them to become symptomatic before they are no longer considered exposed. But we would hope that, as Fire Marshal Parisi had mentioned the other day, that you would take some time to perhaps consider some initiatives, including funding used to assist members with mental health during this pandemic and afterwards, and that our members have responded to calls outside of their normal duties, which has certainly added to stress and anxiety, and a mental health component could help alleviate such problems in the future. We'd also hope that you would consider some sort of local municipal relief as the nation and state begin to recover economically. We fear that the municipal budgets will be affected by declining revenues, and budget reductions will lead directly to service cuts, and that would eliminate boots on the ground on the front lines. And I would hope that you could do all that you can to eliminate this possibility and make sure citizens of our state are safe and that the resources are available to help the local cities and towns. Additionally, as a consideration, there has been a bonus system that's been extended to other employee groups on the front lines, and I would hope that if these programs are going to be expanded, that we would be considered for these as well. While the pandemic has certainly changed our normal protocol for responding to calls in our community, we certainly are going to be needing more remote learning opportunities to ensure that the best practices for the safety of our members and the public are communicated and kept up to date as we practice safe social distancing and try and make sure that in the future we're not meeting in large groups. Additionally, please consider some grant programs to help municipal public safety agencies receive funding, similar to the grant process that the state already manages, which is administered and security, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which allows for training equipment and apparatus purchases. The firefighters and EMTs of this state have always been ready to respond to the needs of our community, especially in times of crisis. And we ask that you consider these requests that the fire marshal put to you much more eloquently and in depth than I did here today. But again, in the interest of brevity, my written testimony has been submitted. I'm happy to take any questions or turn it over to Scott Naismith.
Thank you, Mr. McQuillan. Are there any questions? I don't see any, so thank you very much for that presentation, and I appreciate you keeping them brief. Mr. Naismith, your turn.
Yes,
sir.
Good afternoon. Can you all hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right, great. I am currently here in my office at the Salem Police Station, where I work as a police officer, and I am alone. My name is Scott Naismith. I am the current president of the New Hampshire Police Association. First, let me thank you for allowing me and Bill McQuillan to speak to you today on behalf of first responders throughout the state. The New Hampshire Police Association is a benevolent organization made up of rank-and-file police officers, chiefs, sheriff deputies, corrections officers, and probation and parole. Our members represent both large and small departments, from Swansea to Portsmouth and Berlin to Nashua. I would like to begin by saying how proud I am of our group for dealing with this pandemic. They're dealing with circumstances that no one has seen or had to deal with before, while adapting and responding to calls with one focus, to continue to provide the residents of their communities with the level of safety and security that they have come to expect here in the state. The security has come with one unexpected risk, one that was not taught at our police academy, one that our bulletproof vests could not protect us or our families from. That risk is COVID-19. I've spoken with officers from across the state, and the topic is always the same. These officers are worried about bringing COVID-19 home to their spouses, their children, and their parents. But they all continue to go to work and answer every call for assistance. The dynamic has changed quite a bit in regards to the type of calls we are now handling across the state as well. The most dangerous calls for law enforcement are increasing at an alarming rate. These calls include domestic disturbances between family members, assaults, burglaries due to many businesses being closed, and the businesses that were able to remain open are now seeing large amounts of theft from organized crime retail groups. The state's numerous SWAT teams continue to be called out to deal with dangerous felons as well. This has added to the already high stress and anxiety levels of first responders, in addition to the anxiety of conducting usual law enforcement activities. At this time, I would like to take a minute to recognize EOS Assistant Commissioner Perry Plummer and Fire Marshal Paul Parisi, who are managing the New Hampshire Emergency Operations Center. You heard from Marshal Parisi at your last meeting. Their dedication to the state of New Hampshire and their support of law enforcement has been absolutely amazing. They've never been too busy to take a call from us at any time. Early on in this pandemic, both men took time to do a conference call with members of law enforcement. They listened to our concerns and responded with precision and addressed each and every concern that we raised. The major concerns were PPE for law enforcement, quarantine housing for officers who are exposed to COVID-19 while working, and waiting for their test results. These officers chose to stay in a designated housing area away from their family members in order to protect them from exposure to this virus. As of today, there are currently 32 police officers in quarantine around the state. The last concern that was addressed was the need for expedited testing for officers who are exposed. There are many smaller departments in the state that could not afford to lose an officer for 2 weeks, so the testing needed to be a priority, and it was. You heard Marshal Parisi raise this point on Wednesday, but I cannot stress the fact enough that law enforcement has been having an extremely hard time as well attracting and retaining police officers. As we believe the COVID-19 pandemic is going to exacerbate this problem further, because there is a new stress that has been placed on the backs of all New Hampshire police officers. This COVID whiplash that we are expecting will also place a huge strain on our local communities. Many local towns and cities are already planning for a serious financial deficit to their budget from lost revenue due to this pandemic. The court systems in this state will also see a massive backlog for trials and an issue with arraignments and large amounts of people who will need to go before a judge. We are not here to debate logistics or procedures. I am here to express our concerns, and we believe that if the state of New Hampshire can address these three areas of concern that we have, it will help strengthen law enforcement as a whole in the residents of New Hampshire. The first, if funding is available, we believe anything you can do to augment first responder pay will have a lasting effect on future recruitment and retention of existing first responders. Second, we would support an allocation to help cities and towns to supplement the upcoming shortfalls that will ultimately translate into increased residential taxes. Due to the negative impact of COVID-19 on the stock market, and municipal revenues, we foresee budgetary shortfalls from increases in municipal responsibilities to the New Hampshire retirement system and other bonded commitments. This will directly affect law enforcement budgets. Lastly, we ask that you appoint a committee comprised of law enforcement, the court system, the Attorney General's office, and others to work on a remote video system that will address bail settings, search warrants, arrest warrant requests, and all other applicable court functions to limit exposure to the COVID-19 virus. This will limit contact with sick and dangerous suspects. It will address other concerns that bail commissioners have been trying to bring forward over the last legislative session. Officers and or bail commissioners will not need to travel to meet and review or swear to documents. This will make it safer during inclement weather and improve availability on both ends. Again, if possible, to set aside funding to develop such a system in the near future. In closing, we understand that we could be facing a reoccurrence of this pandemic later this year. We hope these suggestions will help to strengthen New Hampshire as we move forward to fortify our infrastructure and resolve. Let me close by saying, again, how pleased I am to be here in unison with Bill McClellan. I can't be more proud of the job my fellow police officers have done during these trying times, and I can assure you and every resident of the great state of New Hampshire that you are in good hands. Thank you. Thanks to the commitment of these men and women. Thank you. I can take any questions if there are any.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Naismith? I don't see any. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Our next presentation is going to be from the DD community, requested by Representative Wallner. I see that we have Sarah Aiken from Community Bridges with us, and I think we're also looking for Jonathan Ruthier, but I don't see him signed in at this point in time unless you are in under a different number that we're that's not showing, so if we could hit 5-star, Mr. Ruthier, if you're with us, that would allow us to identify the line you're on. Ms. Aiken, are you ready to move forward?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. And I do know that Jonathan has joined us as well, so I think he's on the line.
Yep, he just hit 5-star. We see him. We're ready with him, too. So please go right ahead.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Again, my name is Sarah Aiken. I work for Community Bridges here in Concord, and I am alone in my home in Concord. I wanted to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak and give us a chance to share with you what's been going on in our organizations. I'd also like to thank our staff very briefly, all of the area agencies and the vendors. It's important for everyone to remember that so many of these workers are sacrificing not only their own needs, but the needs of their own families to serve the individuals that we care so much about. Our staff didn't sign up to potentially put themselves in harm's way when they came to work for Community Bridges, but they've consistently stepped up to the plate, and I'm really proud to call them my coworkers. Community Bridges is an organization that supports people throughout the lifespan who experience developmental disabilities and acquired brain disorders here in Merrimack County. We also serve parts of Hillsborough County. We serve those folks through 3 Medicaid waivers, and approximately 90% of our funding goes directly to the services, with more than 90% of our funding coming from Medicaid. To get down to the nitty-gritty, COVID-19 has put us all in a position of expenditures that we weren't prepared to spend, and also with some pretty significant losses to our organization. We have lost about $250,000 in day services. So those are programs for people, adults, with developmental disabilities, specifically for things like assistance with daily living and being integrated into the community. We've also had some pretty intense expenditures totaling somewhere between $450,000 and $500,000. That has to do with things that you might not expect. We've had to do very significant internal IT upgrades, phone system upgrades, laptop upgrades. A lot of our staff didn't have laptops. They would work on a desktop here in our office. And now that we've transitioned folks more safely to be working from home, we have had significant expenditures, not only on the laptops themselves, but in our IT structure that we weren't expecting in order to accommodate all of the work from home. And that work from home allows us to continue the services that we provide to the 1,300 individuals that we serve in a way that assures that they're getting what they need. We've also had a significant change in our staffing. We have approximately 521 staff with 348 full-time folks. We've had to furlough almost 50 staff. We've reduced hours for another 20 or so staff, and we have another 25 folks out on either leave or FMLA, and that's about 16% of our workforce. With that significant change in our workforce, our services that we provide haven't changed. The needs of the individuals that we serve don't stop being needed. In fact, there has been an increase in the needs of the services that our system serves, and I can give you a few examples. Assistance with transportation or respite for families. We have individuals who don't and have never slept through the night. And so their families need some additional supports right now that they weren't anticipating. Significant increase in needs for special education services and supports to families. Even some basic things like food and shelter. We have a food pantry, not only for our staff, but now we have food pantry services for the individuals that we serve. And our biggest ask right now is to make sure that we utilize flexibility through our current budget and that we not only support the area agencies, but our vendors, our mental health providers, and all of our healthcare partners, because without their support, the needs of our individuals won't be able to be served adequately. I would ask that you remember that 1 in 5 people in New Hampshire have disabilities, and that when you are making decisions as you move forward, I ask that you include people with disabilities in your decision making. And I just want to make sure everyone understands that our area agency system, as always, is doing everything that we can to mitigate the risks to our community as a whole. We're also doing everything that we can to mitigate the cost of the programs that we have and are taking lean measures seriously, as we always do, but we do need some assistance. We look forward to working with all of you now and in the future to serve New Hampshire's most vulnerable citizens. And at this time, I'm going to turn my conversation over to Executive Director of our association, Jonathan Ruthier, who will provide you with a system-wide view.
Thank you, sir. Can everybody hear me okay now?
Yes, we hear you fine, sir. Thank you.
Oh, wonderful. I hit 5-star a couple of times, so we're live. Well, thank you very much, Sarah, for the introduction, and Commissioner Little and members of the board for the opportunity to speak today. I'd also like to really give a huge shout-out to the Department of Health and Human Services, who have been absolutely heroic and incredible to work with throughout this pandemic. They've just done incredible work. On behalf of the 10 area agencies in New Hampshire, I want to kind of walk you through a little bit about what our response has been and what some of the needs are from a system-wide perspective. When I say system, I want to make sure that I'm clear that the area agencies are 10 organizations, but they are really the organized healthcare delivery system for all services to people with developmental disabilities and acquired brain disorders in the state. And so included in our system are approximately 60 private providers that contract with area agencies to provide services in addition to the 10 area agencies. When the pandemic really started to flare here in New Hampshire, or prior to the surge here in New Hampshire, the area agencies really responded quickly to address a multitude of challenges. They mobilized to implement social distancing and remote work. They developed temporary housing arrangements to provide support to people who needed respite or who may have tested positive or had to leave a home care situation because a home care provider tested positive. They set up mobile vans to support delivery of food, medication, and other items. And through our association, we centralized communication with all of our private providers to improve efficiency and maintain the consistency of messaging throughout this, so that the amount of questions being asked could be dealt with in a streamlined manner. We've also gone out to source personal protective equipment, and as of right now, the area agency system through CS&I is processing all of the long-term care stabilization payment applications, and that's for over 4,400 employees in our system through CS&I. So we're really, we're operating with everybody in the boat, and we've really seen a lot of positive partnership throughout all of this. With all of those mobilization efforts, the area agencies have made significant investments in various services, and those include you know, any effort to make sure that individuals and families, as well as those providing direct service, were properly supported during the pandemic. Every area agency enacted a continuity of operations plan because we don't go out of business when there's a pandemic. We have to continue to serve because we are a vital and essential element of the health and human services offerings here to the citizens of New Hampshire. But the vast majority of these costs to mobilize have absolutely no identified revenue stream to support them. So in your packets, I did provide a summary of some of the COVID-related expenses to date borne by the area agencies themselves. And these numbers do not include the private providers. And just to point out a few examples, the area agencies have spent about $117,000 collectively in personal protective equipment and medical supplies, have given out about $33,000 worth of supports to families, whether that's gift cards or helping somebody make a rent payment or a car payment. We've spent about $290,000 in remote support technology, and in some cases that required a full upgrade of servers and phone systems to make that feasible, about $225,000 in temporary housing arrangements, et cetera. I will point out quickly, too, that many of the area agencies engage in fundraising efforts, and the funds from those efforts generally go to supporting clients for things that are not covered by client benefits, and that would include things like dental procedures and other care items, and so that number is included. So that the summary of all of those types of expenses nets about, at this point in time, about $1.3 million. And we're expecting some of those costs will continue to grow, particularly with the ongoing need for PPE as we start to loosen up social distancing and start to engage in further community support services. As I mentioned, those numbers do not include all of the private providers and what they have spent out of pocket. And if the committee is interested, I'd be happy to reach out to the providers and try to get a summary of that as well. The next area I'd like to talk about is just the revenue impact to our system, in which we've really seen significant declines, as Sarah mentioned, in day services, which is a significant portion of services in our system. And as of the end of last week, I'm sorry, as of the middle of April, we're seeing an average decline in weekly revenue from day services of about $600,000 a week. The early supports and services for children ages 0 to 3, again, that revenue is down on average about $60,000 a week because people are not able to get out and see people in their homes, do the comprehensive assessments, et cetera. So, and while, we're seeing this trend right now at about $600,000 a week, it's important to understand that that number is likely to expand over the next several weeks, as we experience the revenue shortfall from closing or reducing of day program services. So what does that all mean? Really, it means a weakening of the safety net and potentially a loss of some of our provider partners. It's important to understand that prior to the COVID pandemic, having enough providers in our system was an area that we struggled with. And, we really have to rely on our partnerships with providers to ensure that people have adequate choices for services and, that they're served in a robust manner. So, we're concerned about the potential loss of further providers through this. We're also concerned about the decreased ability to support administrative and fixed costs with those changes in revenues. And we've also seen a number of furloughs or layoffs in our system because of the day services change. And as of April 27th, 27 employers have reported to us a total of 331 employees on furlough. We're starting to see some of the impact here of the COVID crisis. I'd like to spend just a minute talking about the Paycheck Protection Program, which has really been very favorably received. We have 9 of the area agencies that were approved for Paycheck Protection. which is great. I think one of the things that we want to offer for consideration to this board is that the one organization that did not qualify because of the number of their employees would really benefit from similar type of assistance to make sure that they can ride out this this challenging time. I'm speaking specifically about Northern Human Services, which is both the area agency as well as the mental health center for the northern part of the state. They serve over 4,600 individuals, and they employ over 660 people in Coos, Grafton, and Carroll counties. It's really important to understand within our system that an area agency or community mental health center, in this case, two elements in one organization, does not sort of stand alone. That when they are threatened or if there's a negative financial picture with that type of organization, there is a widespread impact that goes beyond the boundaries of their organization. And so that can potentially lead to strain on families, on the hospitals in the region, police, other area agencies, New Hampshire Hospital, et cetera. And so we feel like it's really important as a system to ensure that all of our members are strong. And so I'd ask, as I get to the conclusion here, that we give strong consideration to our partners in the North Country. I think also when you consider the fragility of the economy in the North Country right now, you can really easily conclude that this should be a high priority item for funding. So, again, in your presentation materials, on slide 15, I have a summary of some of the projected needs. The first is, as I just spoke about, the Paycheck Protection Program or a similar offering for agencies over 500 employees. And based on the PPP formula in the CARES Act, Northern Human Services would request an amount of about $4.6 million, and that's based on the elements that would be included in the PPP formula. Reimbursements for the COVID-related expenses, as I mentioned earlier, that totaled about $1.3 million. And lastly, on this slide, I'd like to just discuss a little bit about the shortfalls in revenues. I think whatever we can do to make sure that we have access to the legislative appropriation to make sure that we're maintaining the state the safety net is really important. And if we were to project 6 months at the current shortfall in day services, we'd be looking at about $15.5 million in shortfall there. So in summary, I'd like, again, to thank you for allowing us to speak today. And I'm hoping that you will consider many of these efforts to stabilize our safety net, to assist our member who did not qualify for the PPP, and to reimburse, provide reimbursement for costs that were incurred that are not reimbursable through other means. And then lastly, again, just a consideration as the legislature starts to think about reconvening at some point in the near future, to consider advancing the Medicaid rate increase, which is slated for January of 2021, to an earlier date, again, to keep the provider network strong to meet the needs of New Hampshire. So I will stop there, and I think both Sarah and I are available for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ruthier. Are there questions for either Mr. Ruthier or Ms. Aiken? Senator Morse, do you have a question, sir?
Yes, Jerry. I guess my question is, on the payroll protection plan for the last agency, do they have a value on that?
Yeah, it's $4.6 million.
Thank you.
Further questions for this group? I don't see any, so thank you both very much for your presentations this afternoon. And
thank you.
You're welcome. In our attempt to facilitate the request that we complete our agenda by 3 o'clock. We're going to move around in the schedule a little bit, and at this point we're going to drop down to our planned presentation from 2:50 to 3:10, which is a discussion of early child care and education with DHH Associate Commissioner for Human Services and Behavioral Health, Chris Tappan, and Deputy Commissioner, Department of Education, Christine Bennett. Chris and Christine with us.
Hello, this is Christine Tappan and Christine Brennan here. Yes, we're here.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining us. Please go right ahead with your presentation.
Great. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Associate Commissioner at the Department of Health and Human Services, and I oversee the Human Services and Behavioral Health programs at the department. I'm here today with my partner in all things early childhood, Christine Brennan, who's the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Education. We thank you so much for this opportunity to be here with you today to provide information and recommendations to you about how to stabilize and advance the early childhood care and education system in New Hampshire due to the impact of COVID. The information we'll be sharing with you has been developed with broad stakeholder input, including parents, child care providers, program staff from across both of our departments, experts in the field, and our philanthropic and advocacy partners. Our goal is to inform the decisions you need to make by looking across a couple of questions. What was the state of early childhood care and education system before COVID? What's been the focus on the immediate needs of the early childhood care and education system during COVID? And what needs to be done to rebuild or reboot and strengthen the system now? We'll be talking about how we're leveraging partnerships with other state agencies like New Hampshire Employment Security to dig deeply into the intersection between childcare and employment sectors or industries to begin to create financial models to help us determine how to best move people, parents, from unemployment to work, particularly for those essential workers like childcare and grocery employees, and for industries as they reopen and parents go back to work. We're going to also share an example with you of how we're listening closely and learning as childcare providers at the local level in regional coalitions of early childhood care and education providers are visioning to create the education system as a whole. We're tracking real-time needs of parents, children, and childcare programs to understand the implications of COVID on maintaining safe environments and viable business operations going forward. Now I'm going to hand off our conversation to Commissioner Brennan.
Good afternoon, everyone. New Hampshire has a mixed delivery system of early childhood care and education. Our system for children is about supporting all families where they live, work, play, grow, and learn, and supporting the development of all of our children, parents, and families to be healthy contributors to their communities and help all of New Hampshire thrive. Child care in particular gives thousands of working families peace of mind while it keeps our economy moving. We're talking about our child care system, which serves children 0 to 12, that includes camps, summer camps, and after-school systems, who also serve children from 5 to 12. And each piece of the puzzle has some distinct needs, but consistent among them are needs related to increased cleaning and hygiene protocols and supplies. We also need to consider the reduced classroom sizes and group sizes as we move forward. The approach we outline needs to be a 2 to 3 year plan that identifies current funding streams to leverage and key the gopher ask as part of a larger plan to strengthen and stabilize the child care market. Beyond outlining the process of reopening, this proposed plan should, number one, strengthen parent partnership and be responsive to family needs. We also need to identify a strategy to increase the capacity of the system and to understand and articulate its needs locally and statewide. Also, we need to outline the unique needs of the small businesses that provide childcare as being integral to the fabric of New Hampshire. We need to identify sustainable federal dollars and state dollars, leverage business supports, and map out our workforce. Next slide. I'm not sure if you see that there. We're going to give you a quick backdrop of the current landscape of the early childhood care and education system. Before COVID, including structure and resources. Then we're going to talk about how things are looking now now that we are living with COVID every day. We'll also give you a sense of the range of funding needed to reboot and strengthen or build back a better system beyond COVID. Early childhood care and education are critical to the current and future economy of New Hampshire. Child care is both an essential service to New Hampshire's employees and employers. New Hampshire's early childhood care and education system is positioned to shift to meet the evolving needs for employers and employees due to COVID. Through our deep and broad partnerships across government, community, businesses, and families, we have a ready structure to support families and coordinate and distribute resources and support. We've already demonstrated this by standing up the Early Child Care Collaborative and Program quickly and successfully. We want to touch briefly on three key initiatives we've been working on together over the last couple of years. These efforts are tightly linked to ensure efficient uses of our resources, quality, and improved experiences for children and family. They include our preschool development grant, the Whole Families Approach to Jobs, and our Council for Thriving Children. All of these efforts have been steadily progressing. However, due to COVID, resources are needed to urgently stabilize, reboot, and continue system advances. So we began our journey together over 2 years ago. Building off the work of SPARC and others, we successfully wrote and received a PDG grant to conduct an in-depth needs assessment of the early childhood education system and to initiate strategic planning. We then applied for a second round, and we were awarded over $27 million for more than 3 years. So our goals for this grant are to build a sustainable structure and enhance coordination. So even before COVID-19, our needs assessment told us that families reported difficulty with finding childcare, as you can see from the slide. So while the problems tended to impact low-income families most often, even families earning more than $90,000 a year reported some difficulty. Families in rural communities also reported more difficulty, and you can see that on the slide. The top reasons why childcare could not be found, we had 43% of the people could not afford any care options. 35% could not find a provider with the quality that they wanted. 33% did not have available hours or locations that fit the family's needs, and 27% could not find a provider with space, and 27% could not find quality of the care that they wanted. I'm going to hand it off to Chris to talk about Whole Families.
Great. So as we've been working on the preschool development grant and really thinking through how to better coordinate our early childhood care and education system, part of what we learned about was that there was certainly an economic connection between childcare and parents' ability to go to work. So we've been working intensively together over the last 18 months with some of you who are on the Gopher Legislative Advisory Board there, to create clear economic mobility pathways for New Hampshire's working families. So by taking a whole family's approach to jobs, which is helping parents work while they know their kids can thrive, we're looking to connect the need for safe, stable, and nurturing environments for kids to parents' ability to attain and maintain employment. We know through all of our research and what parents tell us is that when parents worry less about their child's care while they're at work, they perform better at work, and they stay in the workforce longer and more successfully. In our Whole Families approach to jobs, we've had a legislative committee working on economic and benefits analyses to generate policy ideas on how to solve the cliff effect in New Hampshire. That's the situation where when someone is on public benefits and they go to work, and then they begin to see increases in their wages due to promotion or additional hours, they then experience a significant reduction in income, a cliff in their benefits. Overall, the family's household resources drop, and the family is worse off than before. This is a really important, critical part of our work, especially for parents with young children, as we know that two-thirds, or approximately 70%, of the families referred to our child welfare system in New Hampshire for an assessment, have neglect identified as one of the concerns. So due to COVID, we're actually looking to expand the economic analysis of the cliff effect and employment that we have ongoing now with the New Hampshire Employment Security. Brian Gottlieb and Rich Labors have done an amazing job working with DHHS and other partners to really understand how we can leverage the work we've done to date to now create models about how to get families back to work. I'm going to move now quickly to just talk about our Council for Thriving Children. Some of you may be aware that in January, an executive order set forth a new early childhood council for the governor and for our state. The Council for Thriving Children really brings together all of these efforts that Christine has been talking about that we've all been working on in New Hampshire to coordinate a more robust early childhood care and education system. The intention is to make sure that we have the parts of government in particular being data-driven in their decision-making, but that they connect up with many of the key stakeholders, parents, grandparents, business, the legislature, a whole variety of experts to make sure that we're coordinating the system and we're doing what's best for kids and families. The goal of the council overall is a system that really is effective and positions families at the center, is inclusive and offers a continuum of services and supports. It's responsive to the diverse set of stakeholders, families, professionals, and communities. It's efficient and builds on the capacity of families and the professional system, particularly around transitions for children between early childhood care and education settings, and then it's evidence-informed. So that because of this effort that we've had over the last 2 years together, we were able to stand up our Emergency Child Care Collaborative, which is a partner with the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and other stakeholders, and kick off an emergency child care program in just a few days. You may be aware, and we shared some additional materials along with our PowerPoint today that give you an update on where we are with the Emergency Child Care Program. We essentially have about 240 programs serving 5,000 kids across the state. These are kids that are the children of essential workers and employers, including healthcare, grocery store employees, teachers. And what we've done is really tried to use this as a learning experience, a testing lab, so to speak, around what's going to keep the safest operations in environment of a child care setting. And also for us to understand what are the wage and income issues that are associated with running a child care system so that we can get child care professionals back to work. A quick example I want to give at the local level of what's happening as well is that we have the Upper Valley Early Childhood Care and Education Association has been working over the last year to provide deep and intensive coordination and support services to a particular part of our state. What they were able to do during COVID is move really swiftly and pull together a team, particularly financial consultants, to help to understand how are childcare operations going to look differently in the time of COVID. And we're excited to share with you that although we don't have concrete numbers yet, that between this effort and our effort with New Hampshire Employment Security, we believe within the next week or so, we will have some concrete information as we understand industries are opening to be able to project what the funding needs may be as we look towards rebooting and rebuilding the early childhood care and education system. I want to touch quickly on our family resource centers, or what we call our comprehensive family support programs around the state. Some of what we know from our preschool development grant is that families also need ways to be connected within their communities beyond childcare. Many families go in and out of different kinds of needs, building parent capacity for new parents, ensuring that parents have access to food and other kinds of supports, social emotional support, behavioral support for their children. So we've also been tracking our family resource centers and these programs around the state. And what we're hearing is that there is, due to COVID, their referrals are down, in part because of the access issues, because people have been abiding by the stay-at-home. We've initiated telehealth services and supports. They're doing telechecks with families. We're hearing that there is a need for food. We're assisting with food delivery and connecting with community resources like childcare. The challenge here is that the technology in particular and the other investments that are going to need to be in place for these family resource centers related to safe environments for COVID are going to add an extra cost for these family resource centers that we're concerned about. So we want to quickly touch on the structure and resources, and then we're going to look to wrap up with a couple of examples from New Hampshire Employment Security around childcare and grocery store employees. What we know is we have a structure. We've talked about it. We have a structure with and through our Council for Thriving Children, our Emergency Child Care Collaborative and Program, our Preschool Development Grant, our regional coalitions, and the extensive partnerships that are ongoing. We also know that we do have resources in the system. Parents and families are paying when they can. They are, many of them are receiving free child care or discounted child care through the CARES Act and other resources that New Hampshire has been able to put into that, including from philanthropy and business. And we also know that we have the resources from the Department of Education. But our concerns are that this might not be enough. And so what we've done with our partnership at New Hampshire Employment Security is that we've asked them to help us to look at the key issues. And on one of your slides, it says, the issue, New Hampshire economy cannot reopen or essential industries operate at capacity without expanding access to and affordability of childcare. And essentially what we've tried to lay out for you, and I'm not going to go through each of these due to our time, is really to help you to understand that we do have a challenge right now. Many of our child care workers have faced a difficult decision about whether to continue to work or to go on unemployment benefits. And part of what this has done is constructed a situation for us where we have invested through our emergency child care program an incentive payment equivalent to approximately $5 an hour that is intended to go to staff wages, but it's still not quite enough, particularly when a family may need to make a choice about whether to pay for childcare themselves if that's not available at their childcare center. Why that's important, there's a great slide that was created by Brian Gottlieb for us, is that keeping essential industries, particularly those like grocery stores, and he shared with us here a look at what are the childcare needs of grocery stores, of supermarket employees, and what we found is that 26% of them are in need of some type of childcare. So it's really critical as we look at industries to reopen that we understand what their childcare needs are. And we align that with how we reboot and reinitiate the expansion or reopening of our childcare centers as well. A quick touch on a story, just one example we have. It sort of is a collection of the many stories we've heard, but we have many two-parent families that are facing the situation of an example of one parent working in the grocery store business and another parent being a child care provider. They have two young children. They have one who is school age and one who is in preschool, and they face the situation of do they both stay in the workforce or do they stay home? And when you add the cost of child care and the opportunity to potentially have the unemployment for the time being, many families have chosen for the person who is working in the child care professional, typically mom, to stay home and care for their own children. But these parents, these moms, these professionals in child care want to get back to work. So how do we do that? We've prepared for you. You had a second handout that goes over the large areas, the rolled up areas that we believe we need funding to assist with this reboot to the system. Funding to support the social distancing that will now be required for both child care and family resource centers. Funding to respond to the elevated health requirements, funding that will help with what we know will be children who will have difficulty transitioning back, that may have experienced difficulties in their home, may have special education needs or other needs that they have, and funding to support supplies. We also know that we need to look at our rate structures within the child care settings. We know that our current per child reimbursement rates will not be sufficient. And so we want to look at, we've already begun to look at, how we could create stabilization and retention grants for those programs that would focus them on the ability to compensate for smaller ratios, group sizes, to have some flexibility with their labor pool as potentially people go in and out due to COVID exposure, and potentially additional health care and liability. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Christine to wrap up for us.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. Our governance structure is primed and ready to serve the Council for Thriving Children, and it includes all voices. DHHS and DOE's early childhood integration teams are already operationalized and have a joint charter for long-term sustainability, not just depending on relationships. Our experts and advocates are here to advise and lead our council with accurate data and analysis for informed decision-making to serve each community's unique needs. Because of the work on the preschool development grant and partnership with UNH, we are able to use the Department of Education's grants management system, which is a tool that's already been proven to be effective with the $30 million of infrastructure funds that went out to schools in a rather timely manner. We're already set up to provide, provide a workflow for our community grants and set clear collaborative parameters, compliance, and accountability in an efficient manner. So we are ready to build it back and make it better. The New Hampshire Charitable Foundation and DHHS are co-leading the Emergency Child Care Collaborative. Both groups are aligned in a private-public partnership. We also have New Futures and Department of Health and Human Services, who are also co-leading the Rebuild and Recovery for Child Care Plan. These partnerships are going to be what makes our system better for early childhood, and it will serve our families.
And with that, we just want to offer, we did offer additional data in an appendices for you. We know that we don't have time to answer those questions today, but would offer that up to respond to any questions in the future.
Thank you very much, Chris and Christine. I really appreciate it. I would like to suggest to the committee that if we're going to fulfill your request to be done before 3 o'clock today, we should probably hold questions. If you have questions for today's presenters, you can send them to my attention via email, and I will make sure that they get distributed to everybody. And with that, thank you again, Chris and Christine, and we will move on to Commissioner Jasper from the Department of Agriculture. Commissioner, are you with us? Commissioner Jasper?
I am here. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, and I believe that you have Rob Johnson with you as well.
That's correct. I am here today with Rob Johnson, the Executive Director of New Hampshire Farm Bureau. Rob and I have been working together to develop our ask on behalf of New Hampshire farmers. One of the things we want to ask for but can't quantify is to have money earmarked for advertising. If you support putting money into advertising for tourism, we ask that you work with Commissioner Caswell to earmark some dollars for activities supporting New Hampshire agriculture. Our first real ask will be for the dairy industry. I will speak to that area, and Rob will speak to our general request. Thankfully, there have been very few changes in the number of dairy farms in the last year or so. However, the effects of COVID-19 on milk prices put about two-thirds of our remaining dairy farmers at risk. Of the 90 or so remaining farms, only 21 of them purchased the margin protection insurance. Historically, this program has not been the best use of their limited available cash. The program provides insurance for the cost of feed versus the price of milk, and like any insurance, can be purchased at various levels of protection. Given that the price outlook for 2020 was very positive, some cash-strapped operations made the decision not to pursue purchasing the insurance. At any rate, having this insurance will not make up for the disaster the dairy industry is now facing on a countrywide basis. As a member of the Northeast States Department of Agriculture, I have joined with other members in asking Secretary Perdue to help the dairy industry through the price support, through price supports for milk. However, just this week, a similar request was rejected. So while I don't hold out much hope for relief in terms of a guaranteed price, I am hopeful that other help will be forthcoming from Washington. While many of us have seen shortages of milk in our own stores, we've also heard about milk being dumped. Part of the issue is that with automated ordering systems that large grocery stores use to place orders, they did not adjust accordingly. That combined with the closure of schools and restaurants led to the dumping. We expect some balancing to take place. However, prices are falling and farms are being asked to cut production by up to 15%. This is leading to the slaughter of milk cows, and with many slaughterhouses being closed due to COVID-19, the prices for culled dairy cows are falling. If a market for them can be found at all, this is making the situation for our farms all the worse. The bottom line is that without relief money for our dairy farms, many will go out of business. Of course, farms are much more than part of our food supply. They are also an important part of who we are as a state and why people come here to visit. Agritourism is a big part of our economy, and until the pandemic came about, it was a growing part. So let me get to the ask for the dairy industry. Our most recent numbers show that New Hampshire was producing roughly 680,000 pounds of milk a day, which translates to about 20,400,000 pounds per month. Our best estimate, which comes directly from our farms, is that about 1.4 million pounds are processed on the farms each month, leaving about 19 million pounds being sold into the fluid milk market. Milk is sold by the hundredweight, so that gives us about 190,000 hundredweight of milk being sold each month. Thankfully, we do know the price, what the price is, and what the 12-month forecast was. Unlike really any other commodity, we have a really good handle on what the need is likely to be. I have compared the February 28, 2020 forecast to the April 28 forecast to develop our ask. The nine-month differential through 12/31/2020 works out to $6.8 million. That is not our ask. We know that there is far less money available than there are asks. We are asking for just under 75% of that projected loss, or about $5 million. There are adjustments that will be made to any support that you might recommend to the governor. As I stated, there are insurance payouts that would need to be deducted from relief that goes to farmers. I would also want to deduct premiums that those who did not purchase insurance would have paid. No one should be rewarded for not having purchased insurance. Of course, any reduction in production would not be subject to relief payments. With decreased production will come reduction in expenses, and I understand that no one will be made whole in this process. Of course, any additional money coming from the federal government should also be deducted from payments made by the state. My hope is to keep farms from being forced out of business. Rob will now speak to our ask of $500,000 to help mitigate the costs associated with COVID-19 on the rest of agriculture. This ask is less precise than the ask for dairy because most of New Hampshire is just starting to gear up for the growing season, and the costs from the most part are best guesses. And while we think that number may go as high as $3 million, we don't know. It's also true that unlike dairy, most other commodities will have some control over their price structure, and should have the ability to recoup some costs by raising their prices marginally. I'll now turn it over to Rob.
Good afternoon. The major component of this request is to address the substantial increase in cost to the state's fruit, vegetable, and ornamental sector in addressing the COVID-19 threat, essentially trying to keep workers and customers safe and helping to ensure confidence in our local food supply. These new costs include extra cleaning and sanitizing, ensuring social distancing on the farm, worker spacing, customer spacing, monitoring customers, more attention to customers. Our pick-your-own enterprises are anticipating they'll be needing, customers will be needing direction. There'll be needs for increased signage, just generally greater monitoring. There's individual product packaging has increased greatly. Creating and expanding space in stores, farm stores, stands. Some enterprises have already added a second and or are planning adding a second or third cash register. Some are planning on installing plexiglass. And then there's also the expectations of customers, providing curbside pickup, home delivery, ordering online, establishing and adhering to protocols. It makes all processes longer, and it requires labor. And that's the biggest component of this, the additional labor. in order to get a handle on a number, working with UNH Cooperative Extension, we targeted some of the larger growers in the state to get an idea, and we asked four questions. You know, and the questions were their experience so far with labor, personal protective equipment, and other expenses relative to the COVID-19. The mean number response on this was $4,750 that they have incurred so far. Anticipated under the same areas, labor, personal protective equipment, and other, they're anticipating about $18,000. That comes to a total of $22,750. We multiplied that by our estimate. Estimation is that there are about 125 fruit, vegetable, ornamental operations in the state that have a minimum sale of $50,000 in a year. And we were trying to look at this to keep into the enterprises that are dependent on income for their to live. So looking at that, that total number, like the commissioner said, came out to much higher, to close to $3 million. But we're not asking for that. What we're hoping to do is some assistance to help our farms navigate this crisis. Second area that we're looking at is the area of agritourism and related events and cancellations. We're talking about the farm weddings, and in the, as the year goes on, there'll be farm-to-table events that have been scheduled and not happened. Another area would be cut flowers, is an example of another type of event entity. To give you an example, recently speaking with a cut flower operation, they had events scheduled, mostly weddings, starting in April through into the fall. All of their April, both days on the weekend, and they have experienced total cancellations for April, May, and June. Some of those events have been rescheduled for the fall, but it's an unknown, as you're all aware. To show the importance of these avenues, I mean farm sales and agritourism, to the New Hampshire agriculture and to the state, just a couple of numbers I want to share with you. According to USDA data, New Hampshire ranks number one in the country for direct-to-consumer sales. Direct-to-consumer sales, we're talking about at the farm, a farm stand, a pick-your-own operation, a community-supported agriculture, or farmer's market. So again, New Hampshire ranks number one in the country for direct-to-consumer sales as a percentage of total agricultural sales. And the second number I wanted to share with you is Plymouth State, in a study of the New Hampshire economy, has found that nearly 9% of all tourist and business traveler spending can be attributed to agritourism. That includes the product purchase, an experience, or just simply the scenery. And in closing, I'd just like to put in a plug relative to local food purchases, and that as you are providing funds for food assistance, please consider provisions for local food purchases when and where you can. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you very much, Commissioner Jasper. Once again, in an effort to try to hit a out time of 3 p.m., we're going to hold questions today. If members of the committee do have them, please feel free to email them to us here at the Gopher office. We'll make sure they get distributed and answered. So our next presentation is going to be from Early Learning New Hampshire. We have Board Chairman Scott Spradling and Executive Director Jackie Powell.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you, Scott, and we appreciate your offer to get your presentation done in 10 minutes or so.
Thank you very much, and we will definitely do that. I'm actually sitting in the same office, socially distanced, but speaking with one voice here with Jackie Cowell. So I just want to thank you very much for your time. We wanted to talk about relief for childcare small businesses, and really I think our message can trail off of exactly what Christine and Chris were talking about just a few minutes ago. Let me first just say thank you for all that you're doing, because I know this is an enormous undertaking, but no matter what decisions you make, you're going to be making a difference in the lives of all of us who are trying to rebuild in the wake of this pandemic. So thank you so much for helping all of us get back on track. In just the next few minutes, we're going to explain the impact of COVID on our state's childcare sector, and we have some ideas for a relief response that we believe will allow these essential small businesses to open, to reopen, and to stay open. And I'll finish with an analogy about what we envision this project to look like. But the fact is, the only way we're going to reopen our state's economy and support the decisions that you are making is to ensure that parents have what would need to be immediate access to childcare. No matter how much support is targeted at every important industry, if families can't literally drop their kids off somewhere to get to work, we're going to have some troubles getting this started. So we've got to get this right. So let me call in Jackie at this point and walk us through the basic numbers. Jackie?
Thank you, Scott. And how do you do, everyone? At our presentation, we're now at the chart of New Hampshire childcare and wanted to show you this chart. The number of 46,032 is the number of licensed childcare slots in New Hampshire. There are more slots, in fact, because there are many legally operating license-exempt childcares as well. But I wanted to show you the actual capacity of the slots. It's not a question, it's not an enrollment, but there are more because of license-exempt. 46,000 capacity in February. In February, it is unimaginable that we would give you a chart a few months later that shows 4,875, from 46,000 to 4,875. As you heard from Chris Tappan and Christine Brennan, that number is probably more close to 5,000 right now, and it keeps going higher. We are so appreciative to them for all they're doing, the midnight oil that they're burning, but it's devastating that we've gone from 46,000 to about 5,000. I want to make sure you heard that. The next slide, I'm going to be very brief. In 2009, the New Hampshire Department of Employment Security, for the last time it was done, looked at the childcare industry as a whole. If you took all of these small businesses, nonprofits, privately owned, larger, medium, small, together, what is the economic impact of that childcare industry? And bottom line, I'm not going to read it all, you have it. The economic impacts of the childcare industry, which includes early childhood education, are similar to the economic impacts of travel and tourism. All right, 7.1% of state GDP versus 7.6. You have the information. The point is that this childcare sector, this industry, really is worth making sure it's standing up right now especially. The next slide, childcare is not only a workforce support, it also provides, I'm not going to read it to you because Chris and Christine did a terrific job talking about all the wonderful things besides being there for parents as a workforce, but all the wonderful things that happen for children. So thank you for that. I'm going to really briefly and not repeat the support that's in place right now for the emergency childcare. Again, thank you to the DHHS for stepping up to the plate and putting millions of dollars forward to make sure that there is that $5 per staff per hour pay differential. These places are open. It's terrific. They're on the front lines. So they're getting extra pay. Terrific. This is paid on top of current pay. And the wonderful money they put forward to help income-eligible families not lose their slots, and so the programs can bill. But I really think it's important for folks to know that 90% of the parents who had been there in February of 2020 do not take this scholarship and had been paying privately, and it's really tough for them when they're not there, their program isn't open, what are they doing, and it's really tough for the providers to not collect that revenue. So it's a new world, and it's a big change. We wanted to make sure you heard it. Cleaning supplies, again, thank you so much, and especially also to Chris Tappan, Associate Commissioner Plummer from the Department of Safety for getting those supplies out free of cost, and the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, thank you. I'm not going to repeat what they said about the emergency childcare. So now we have the request.
Jackie's going to walk you through the request very briefly, but we just wanted to explain that we have great appreciation for the emergency supports right now. We're envisioning this need, this investment, to not only get childcare facilities up and running right now as the workforce prepares to return, but to be able to sustain it in this new post-COVID normal.
Thank you, Scott. So the emergency, the ECCP system and the millions of dollars that are there now are not covering the losses of most of child care programs because their bottom line, their numbers are so much smaller, they're lower ratios on purpose, and they're not receiving the revenue that they used to have. That's a twofer. That's a 1-2 punch. Less revenue and less kids and more costs. So we are proposing at Early Learning New Hampshire, respectfully request that you consider setting up a fund immediately for child care relief grants to cover business losses. For those losses incurred from March 1st through December 31st with the funds that you are overseeing and recommending. And so these child care businesses, again, the purpose of these grants to go out right away would be so that they can open, they can reopen, but honestly stay open to recover those losses. That grant process we're recommending is a one that has robust accountability of their proof of need, of what are the gaps between the funding they are getting from either federal or state or philanthropic funding specifically tied to COVID-19. We would ask them to report that, but also report their losses. And we'll talk really quickly about some of those losses they're experiencing. And so the numbers. So the total that we are requesting respectfully and we is $48 million and $420,000. We believe that is what will be needed for 6-plus months, perhaps all the way through December 31st for the costs and losses they are incurring. And so we wanted to make sure, you heard that immediately. Next slide is the allowable uses. So those fixed costs, rent, mortgage, heat, utilities, property taxes, employee benefits, I'm not going to read it all to you because you have the presentation, but their numbers are much less. And so their cleaning supplies, the insurances, all the costs, that if we are very concerned that if an immediate grant process is not put in place with the fact that these places are operating with mandated diminished group sizes for good safety reasons and they still have their fixed costs, we do not want them to lose those facilities. We do not want them, honestly, to close and go out of business. Those facilities are very specifically targeted and designed for the kind of child care business. It would cost so much more to rebuild it, to put it back in place if we lost them. And so I just really wanted to make sure that you knew that there's a place for this conversation. The next slide, ditto what Chris and Chris Tappan said about the Council for Thriving Children and how this could happen, but I really want to emphasize the immediate need of a grant system that would be simple but robust, accountability, and have it go out the door soon.
That graphic that you're looking at on the second to last page basically underscores the fact that this request can be merged in with what Chris and Christine are already doing and that there is a structure that's in place that does not have to reinvent the wheel, if you will. This is also accommodating not only for the losses, but dealing with that post-COVID new normal that we are looking at with the diminished capacity mandates that are going to be a part of these new child care centers and making sure that they can stay afloat with what I would describe as pre-COVID requirements for finances in a post-COVID world. In closing, please note that child care is a critical part of this supply chain, and we want to be ready to go when you are ready to go. I think perhaps a really good analogy is think about our wintertime storm preps. A big storm is coming, and our state's largest utility, Eversource, gets their teams in place, idled, prepped, and ready for when the call comes in. I would say this is the child care analogy that is very similar to that. We need to make sure that our troops are up, ready, idling, and prepared so that as you are calling the workforce back to work, we can get things up and rolling. Jackie?
And Scott, I just want to say those troops are all sizes. They're small, family-based programs in people's homes. There are large multi-site programs and all those programs in between that in February were up and running for New Hampshire's workforce.
And with that, we will wrap and say thank you so very much for your time and your attention in this matter, and we wish you all very well.
Thank you very much, Scott, and thank you very much, Ms. Cowell, for the expedited presentation. Greatly appreciated. It looks like we might make the off time for 3 o'clock. The final speaker scheduled for today is Commissioner Edelblue, but he has graciously agreed. I've got a request from Senator Morse to speak to us for 10 minutes or so. Senator?
Thank you, Jerry. The I'm not sure whether or not you sent out the document that I worked on with Josh and Senator Bradley proofread it for me. But the if you haven't, I think you should send it out. But the basically this document is an attempt to start to get us to think about what we want to suggest to the governor. And we've set it up in a fashion so that the issue would be in the first column. The level of funding is open in the second column. Our ranking of importance would be the third column. Intended use is where I think if you have time this weekend, the committee members should spend a lot of time on, because the this document was done in the sense to make us think a little bit, but as you get into different categories, I'm sure we've all heard enough now, and I'll explain the future, which is at the bottom of the document, that we could start to put in the intended use a lot of different things, and I think it's important that we do that. If you're talking about the unemployment trust fund, even in just something like that, there's different discussions that need to happen. And then the last column, it's about areas for further study. And I think this column basically is the column that catches things like, will the federal government let us do this? So having said that, I've picked several different broad issue categories with the understanding that if you get to the end of the document, I would think many of the members have ideas of their own of categories that they believe we should be funding. So I certainly encourage that, and I did so at the end of the document. But a couple of things to keep in mind. One, I don't believe that, and this is just my opinion, and I'd like to know the committee's opinion, but if we take the 1.2 and allocate it all today and recommend that to the governor, we'll have nothing to go back and fact check to make sure that at the end of May, I'll use hospitals as an example. If we give them March and April, some kind of number, at least we could go back at the end of May and check and see all kinds of things. One, you know, where are we in opening hospitals back up? Two, where are we in federal funding at that point? The numbers that I have looked at, I've only looked at the first allocations that they got, not all the allocations that have been announced since I looked at it. So I'm sure at the end of May, the pitch is going to change again. So anyway, I produced this document to have a discussion on Monday about things that we'd like to talk about funding, what level we're thinking of, how we rank them. I do believe that we need to come up with something to send to the governor. I have listened to the other group that have listened to their presentations. Bill Ottinger is working on something very similar to what I believe needs to happen within our group on the business end. I think in the long run, this is going to be, when we produce a document that we believe in as legislators and talk to the other group that are actually people in the field and match them together to send to the governor. I think that would be a great way to do it. But if the document's produced, if you have time to look at it this weekend and put more facts to it, anything that anyone wants to put on the document to discuss on Monday, I'd encourage. And I'm more than willing to take that information this weekend and add it to the document so that sometime Monday morning I send it back out to everybody. I think it would be a good way to start a discussion. Comments?
Thank you, Senator Morris. That document had not been distributed to the committee. I think it's on its way, or they should have it fairly soon.
Is it? Okay. Jerry?
Yes, sir.
Lou D'Alessandro?
Yes, Senator.
Thank you. Okay. Chuck, I think it's a great start. We should get the document. And Jerry, you said we'd get it today?
Yes, I believe you should have it momentarily.
Okay.
So we get the document.
Okay, we work on it over the weekend. We get back to Chuck. And when are we going to have the joint meeting with these two committees, Jerry, so that we can exchange ideas? If they're producing a document and we're producing a document, when will the two committees come together to discuss the documents, which I think are an imperative as time is moving and we've got to get this money out. There'll be, as Chuck said, a legislative perspective and a business perspective, but bringing the two together, presenting them to the governor, seems to be the first order of business.
Thank you. At this point, we do not have a meeting scheduled, but it's obviously something that does need to happen. This group, the Legislative Advisory Board, is about a week or more ahead of the Stakeholders Advisory Board. You get an earlier start and had a very full early-on schedule and have really plowed through a lot of material, so I think we need to give them a little bit of time to catch up. My understanding of the document that Senator Morse has sent you is an open-ended document, a working document, a living document, if you will, for everybody to sort of put your recommendations and ideas together. And once it's populated, I think it's a great tool to take forward. See, we have questions from Chairwoman Mary Jane Waller.
Thank you. I had a similar question to what Senator D'Alessandro just asked. I was wondering how we saw the two committees, how the work would merge, and that they're a little bit behind us. Maybe we're not ready for that step. But I think it's really important that we start to look at what they're looking at, so we aren't going off in a completely different direction.
Very good. We'll work on that and bring the groups together. Representative Hennessy?
Thank you. I did receive the document just in my email, and I was wondering if we could receive it in a spreadsheet format rather than PDF.
Certainly. We have that version. We will send that to you right now.
Thanks. And also, were you able to get any of the updates from the different state agencies that we requested? One that I'm particularly interested in is the ask of the health care fund. I know that we had received an update as of the 17th of April of what they've given out, but I'd love to know what they still have available and what the total ask has been from the different health care providers in the state.
Of the $50 million fund?
Yes.
Is that the question? Yes. We do have some data. We will send out an email after the call filling you in about that. Thank you very much. Senator Morse, do you have another comment or question?
No, I want everyone to understand, and I certainly call the other committee,
but I think it's important first for us to start to discuss priorities. And I listened in on the nonprofit side yesterday with the other group, and they're definitely hacking over a lot of things that we are, but they actually have some people on their group to serve on some of the things that they're hacking over. So it's interesting to listen to. They went into things that we haven't been into, like the arts and stuff. But I think if we start building this document out and start, you know, putting things to intended use, I mean, I think you'll see where we could go back. Even if we just sent them the document and said, here's what we're thinking, can you guys start working on something and we'll get together? I just think if they're a week behind us and we don't get going on our end of it, we're going to have issues with the governor's going to be ahead of us by far. I mean, I think his office is probably working on something similar. You know, in my conversations with you, they're always asking for data, and I just thought this was a good idea to start to put more detail to it, and then, you know, we can go forward, and I'll definitely talk to Donna Lee and see what she thinks.
Thank you very much, Senator Morse. I appreciate it. So just a quick summary, or just to jump forward a little bit, we will set up for another conference call on Monday at 1 o'clock, bring you back together, hopefully to discuss a focused conversation on process for moving forward. We'll discuss Senator Morse's form. We'll talk about bringing this group together with the Stakeholders Advisory Group on Monday at 1 o'clock. Now, finally, Commissioner Edelbluth, thank you very much for your patience and for graciously letting us fix the schedule up a little bit. And know that we're probably going to start losing people at 3 o'clock to go listen to the governor's press conference. So you with us, Commissioner Edelbluth?
Great. So I will move very quickly through this. Thank you, Director Little. Three things that I wanted to cover with you. The first was I understood that Senator Hennessy had a question about some of the COVID-related costs that we are incurring in the school system. And I would talk about issues such as technology that includes hotspots, cellular devices, software for Zoom and Google, devices for students, internet devices like Chromebooks and tablets that we are acquiring for students, as well as there has been food distribution costs associated with pushing our food out to our families rather than them getting that and accessing that in the schools, transportation costs, some legal costs as well for districts as they are trying to respond to a variety of different kinds of questions, as well as some contract-related costs associated with transportation contracts, cleaning contracts that they have. And some of these are contracts that the schools have been paying out on but have not been in a position to be able to receive some of those services but have been trying to retain some of those contractors. So those are some of the categories of expenses that schools are experiencing. There is a law, RSA 3211, that enables schools, if they have an expenditure in excess of appropriation, to make a request to the department for approval of that. We've not received any of those. I'm not sure if that's because they haven't happened or just because folks are catching up to that. But there is a process in place for those excess expenditures to be processed in law. And so we are prepared for that. So that is trying to be responsive to Senator Hennessy's request. The next two items are just some projects that I want to put on your list of potential investments in the state as a result of COVID to allow us to both respond to and prepare for the future of what COVID might look like as it relates to education. The first is an ask related to a learning management system. New Hampshire has done an outstanding job switching over to remote instruction across the state. a learning management system in the state, across the state, really, that leverages technology that is already deployed in our post-secondary environments, both at the university system as well as in the community college system, and connecting up our K-12 system would allow us to enhance the quality across the board for all of our students so that there is a more equitable opportunity for our students in terms of the quality of the instruction that they receive in a blended or a remote learning environment. And it would be consistent with some of the best practices across the state, you know, looking at, or across the country, looking at states such as Wyoming or Utah. And then the next item that I wanted to put on your radar is relative to internet connectivity. We think an ask in the neighborhood of between $40 and $60 million will go a long way to ensuring that the outer reaches of our students have internet accessibility to be able to access remote instruction. Again, we have done an outstanding job, and I want to compliment all of our interconnection, ISP, and cable providers in the state. They have worked collaboratively and tirelessly to close the gap for as many families as we are able to do that, and we appreciate it. And we want to continue to invest in that infrastructure for all of our households and students across the state. And so I have been able to present those to you in 3 minutes or less, Director Little, and I hope that that was helpful.
Phenomenal. Thank you very much, Commissioner. We do have a question for you from Representative Hennessy.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner, for coming back to us. My question was actually around the dollar amount and not the,
okay,
the types of expenses. Last time you had presented to us, you told us you were tracking informally the excess amount that the schools have had to spend on these COVID-related expenses. And I was just wondering if you formalized that process and if you have a number for us.
Yep. So I actually submitted a number to the committee, so I'm sure we can get that over to you. We had provided some information there, and so we can make that available to you, you know, through the committee. That's probably the most expeditious way for you to have that. Otherwise, I can resend it from our office. As well, I think it's important to consider that in addition to the $1.25 billion that you all are managing, there is a separate CARE Act grant directly to the education system. So we will be receiving $37 million that we will pass through to the schools using a Title I funding formula. So those funds will pass through to the schools that they have broad latitude in terms of how they use that in the schools. But we'll make sure you get the numbers associated with those informal survey.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Representative Hennessy. Thank you, Commissioner Edelblue. And I believe that effectively and quickly, with the assistance of all of our scheduled presenters today, completes today's agenda in time for us to jump off for the 3 o'clock Governor's Press Conference. Any further questions from any member of the committee? Hearing none, just a reminder, we will set up another meeting for 1 p.m. on Monday afternoon and hope to begin our discussion of how you want us to work forward to put some spending proposals before the governor. And with that, thank you all for your time this afternoon. It is now, by my watch, about 2 minutes before 3, and this conference call is ended. Thank you all very much.
Thanks so much, Jerry.